This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
And welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast, brought to you by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative. Leadership is difficult, but not complicated. In this podcast series, I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, or politics. My guest today is Sharmadine Reed, MBE. Sharmadine grew up in Wolverhampton. I was born just down the road in Cannock, by the way. Graduated from Central St. Martin's with a first-class degree and became a brand consultant and fashion stylist for Nike and ASOS. She founded Wah Nails in 2009, which changed the landscape of the beauty industry with its innovative brand, salon spaces, and early adoption of social media. In 2018, to launch her second business, Beauty Stack, Sharmadine raised nearly £4 million in funding, which made her one of only 10 black female entrepreneurs to raise that level of venture capital. And most recently, in 2021, Sharmadine launched her newest venture, The Stack World, a networking community for like-minded and mission-driven women. All the while, she has been consistently documenting her journey and her experience, as well as organizing business events for young female entrepreneurs. She was awarded an MBE in 2015. Welcome to the podcast, Sharmadine.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I would want to take you back to your childhood, first of all, if that's okay. So you grew up as the eldest of four children to a single parent in Wolverhampton. Did you find yourself in an early position of responsibility, do you think, as a consequence of that?
Yeah, 100%. I remember being 9 or 10 years old and like, holding my sister, feeding my sister, like putting her to bed, putting her to sleep. I definitely grew up really fast by mothering and by being a second mom. However, you know, I don't necessarily know if that was a bad thing because now I have an 11-year-old son myself. We live in London. You know, between me and his father, we have no family, like, you know, wider family in London. And I often reflect actually on how this is the first time in humanity that people have lived without second, third, fourth generations, like all around them and supporting. I think it's wholly unnatural to raise a child in a city by yourself. So I wouldn't change it any other way.
Yeah. And also you've talked about that environment you grew up in as being an incredibly supportive environment where you were told you could be whoever or whatever you wanted to be. That just seems to be such an incredible start for anybody. Is that how you view it? Is that how you feel about it today? Looking back on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I would say that we weren't like rich in wealth, but we were definitely rich in community. And I like just to paint the picture, my grandparents who, you know, were born in Jamaica and came to Britain, they had 13 children between them. I had 8 aunties, the rest of them were uncles, plus each one of those, you know, aunties and uncles had children, so I had probably 70 or 80 cousins. Then we had the church, we were Seventh-day Adventists. The church is another 100 or 200 people who are looking after you. And I was definitely a curious and capable child that everyone felt like an aunt to me. You know, in the black community, whether it's Caribbean or Nigerian, you hear the word aunt or mom used indiscriminately against any older woman. Mm. And, you know, auntie, people say, though they're not your blood relative. Yeah. So I felt like I had an almost infinite amount of aunties and moms who were essentially looking out for my well-being, and men actually too. I remember one of the elders at church, Mark Palmer, he was always super supportive of me, like doing anything I could do. So I took it for granted at the time. But when I think now, the worst thing that anyone can do to a child is say that they can't do something, or they're not capable, or they're not good enough. And I definitely didn't have that. Actually, I had teachers as well. Do you know what? I was really lucky. My teacher, Mrs. Forster, Mrs. Maguire from primary school, I remember them all.
Yeah, I mean, it says it all that you can actually remember your primary school teachers' names. I mean, to my shame, I can't, although I'm older than you. And so my next...
Well, actually, Mrs. Forster really changed my life. Because really? Mrs. Forster is the person who made my mom fill out this school application form to go to a school called Thomas Telford, which was 20 miles away, and a whole like ordeal to travel to get into. And that school was a city technology college. Mm-hmm. It was, funded by corporations. They had internet. It was a technology school. It changed the trajectory of my life completely. And had Mrs. Forster not actually said to my mom, "You should really send her here. She's capable of going," things could have looked very different for me.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. I mean, you've half answered my next question. My next question was, in amongst this, you know, this huge community of people, relatives and, I suppose, friends and just the wider community. My question was, were there some particular mentors in amongst that group as you were growing up? I guess you've mentioned a few of those. Was the one or two that particularly stood out, particularly, I suppose, that helped shape your view as to what your career possibly might be or what your future might be?
Do you know something? I would say that the biggest influence on where I could be and what I could do was actually through media.
Really?
So when I was young, probably from age five, so, we had no money, but we had cable. And yeah. We were like the only people on the street to have cable TV. I remember this little black sky box with like the red letter, the digital red numbers. And I remember Sky One like being the first channel that I ever like watched on cable. And cable showed me a whole world, like exploded my world, age five. So that would have been 1989. So I grew up watching The Bold and the Beautiful, Dynasty, Ricky Lake, Jerry Springer, watching MTV. I spent hours watching MTV. Then when I became around 11 or 12, I started buying fashion magazines with my pocket money. I would buy Vogue. Can you believe that? Like a 12-year-old in Wolverhampton. I remember the newsagent that I had to go to get it. Then I'd buy Elle. I'd buy all of these teen magazines and fashion magazines. So media was essentially the internet of my time, right? Like it showed me the possibility of what fashion and art and culture and business, because I was obsessed with watching Oprah as well.
Right.
and all of these chat shows and, daytime TV shows with my mom. And I was like, wow, that is glamorous. Like I'm on, sitting in Wolverhampton in our council house, and yet I'm watching like The Bold and the Beautiful, and there's all these possibilities. So I would say my mentors definitely were a composite of American icons. That's literally what I was influenced by.
And I read that you chose the course you wanted to study at Central St. Martin's when you were 12. But do you think you've always been the sort of person who kind of has a long-term plan?
Yeah, it's funny you talk about this, because I'm really at a kind of juncture at my life right now where I feel like I fulfilled many of the plans I set for myself at a young age. And now I'm like, oh, what should I do now? What next? I've done everything I said I wanted to do.
Wow.
But I have always been a long-term planner. And I would say probably I have a strong imagination, and at the extreme end of it, I could be called a fantasist. But when I was a kid, I would lie in my bed looking through these magazines, listening to the radio, watching TV, thinking, one day I'm going to do that. I'm going to be there, or, I'd like to build this, or I'd like to launch this. And I would say I kind of have my life mapped out till the day I die, assuming I'm going to live long, of course. But I definitely know... have a view in my mind of what I'll be doing at 40, at 50, at 60, 70, 80, fortune willing, however long that I live. But I think that when I was 12, I used to read, as I said, the magazines all the time, and I was obsessed with looking at credits. So I'd look at the masthead of a magazine. I would read every name at the end of a movie or at the end of a TV show. So I'd always be looking at who were the people who were building the products okay. that I loved.
Wow.
Because that's where I wanted to be. And every time I looked at a designer I loved or anyone in fashion, they always went to Central St. Martin's. So I was like, well, I want to go to Central St. Martin's. But I didn't want to make clothes. So then I ordered the prospectus. I remember it came to my grandma's house and I saw this course and I was like, this is what I want to do. It's everything fashion, but without making clothes. And then I telephoned them on my landline and said, what do I need to get onto this course? They were like one A level. I was like, fine, I'll, I was very academic actually. So I was like, that'll be easy. And then I just plotted out my whole school to do this. Degree.
Listening to you talk about the fact that you were, you know, you'd look at who create, you know, you'd read the, not just you'd read Vogue or you'd watch a movie, but you'd look for the names of the people that had actually created that thing that you'd enjoyed, whether it be Vogue or the movie. And you, I think you said almost a fantasist, you know, you'd lie there and you'd dream about all the things you wanted to be. But it strikes me though, that you're not a fantasist. You're able, you look at your incredible career so far, you're able to have a picture in your mind or a vision in your mind of what you'd like to be or achieve. That's actually not very difficult. We can all do that. But what you've got is the doing it. You know, you can then get up and actually go and make it happen. What do you think? Where do you think you get that from? I don't know if that's a question that's even possible to answer, but it seems to me that's the really impressive, difficult bit, the doing, not the dreaming.
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky in having like both sides of the brain in that way. Like, I can be very creative and I can be super commercial. I can be really daydreamy and macro, but then I can also go really down in the weeds and in the details. And I think to answer your question about the reason why I think I've developed, I don't know whether it's nature or nurture, but developed this action orientated side of my skills is because I don't actually have anything or anyone to fall back on. So if I sit there daydreaming and I don't put anything to action, then there's no result. And if there's no results, then I am not going to make myself financially secure. And if I don't make myself financially secure, no one else will. But I've been in the city for 19 or so years now. And over that time, what I realized is that it is this sort of never-ending like ladder, right? Like, you're going up, you're climbing up, you're earning more, you're acquiring more respect, more power, more knowledge, etc. But at the same time, I started to reflect on, well, what has the cost been? And I don't just mean the literal cost of like being stressed all the time or working like 12, 16-hour days, which is one type of cost, but the cost of loneliness, of not being around my family, of not necessarily spending quality time with friends. And I've supported women in their businesses, I've supported women in their work. And what I'm hearing now from them is, actually, we don't want to work. We want to just maintain. So rather than think, okay, if I work 20 or 30 or 40% more than what I'm supposed to, I can get to the next ladder, I can be promoted, etc. I just want to work enough to maintain. And I want to prioritize my family, my friends, myself, my relationships over work.
I get, and you know, in the job I do, I recognize a lot of what you're describing in terms of, you know, what I see and hear within the people that we employ. So if that is a kind of let's say a groundswell of sort of opinion, belief, discussion, what do you think are the potential implications of that? So what are the implications for you as an employer, for us as an employer?
So many, and they're really big, right? Like really big culture generation shifting consequences. So you said me as an employer, and I'm going to start there because, you know, when I said to you earlier that this is a challenge to balance, my biggest challenge is how do I be truthful with my team that I'm aware that this is a feeling for them? While also wanting to motivate them to stay in work and not just like quit and leave. Our relationship with work is what is being redefined right now. So there'll be individual employees resigning or moving to jobs that suit them better, such as more flexibility, remote work, etc. There are going to be people who just go off grid, and I'm always fascinated by these people, actually. I'm fascinated by anyone that rejects society.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm in awe of the people who reject society. But I think if this starts happening more and more, it's a bit like what we saw in COVID. Productivity is going to go down. And, you know, we're already seeing the effects right now. People say that we're heading into a recession of 2 years of lack of productivity, full productivity, lack of supplies, etc. So I think that the young people today are definitely prioritizing their friends, their relationships, the things that they find more important than just making money for a corporation. And it's the role of companies and corporations to think, well, how can we keep them engaged? And for me, it's always been about community. It's like, if I can build a community around the workplace, you're staying for more than just your daily grind. You're staying because you've essentially replaced your family that you've left behind in the suburbs. You've moved to the city and you've got no family. So how can we create a family 2.0 to make work feel like a place that you can bring your whole self to?
Yeah, and I think
this period of reflection, we're calling it the Great Resignation, but what it really is a great reflection.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
It's looking in front of the mirror and being like, has everything I've been working for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years been worth it?
Yeah.
Because we're not necessarily happy.
So you've talked in the past about this being an age of entrepreneurship. And yet, you know, listening to you now, I feel like you maybe aren't so sure that it, you know, you're not so sure about that. Maybe it is an age of entrepreneurship, but maybe, or maybe it is, but it shouldn't be. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm interested in your thoughts.
I think you're right that I'm not sure, if I'm honest. And that's actually quite a big thing for me to say because, yeah, my whole life I've been very, very sure.
Well, you're a serial, it's a cliched expression, but you are a serial entrepreneur. I mean,
yeah, I think that I'm in this period right now of reflecting and questioning what my motives are and what my long-term, if my long-term goals are my own or if they are an image that I've been sold to keep the system running. Which sounds quite existential,
actually. That is. I have no idea the answer to that.
Do you get what I'm saying? You've been in business long enough.
I just don't have an answer. I'm very traditional in the sense that I think that Adam Smith, you know, the economist, was basically right that the human condition is we do strive to improve our, you know, even no matter what, there's nobody at the top telling us that we should try and improve our condition. You know, we want to do that ourselves. And left to our own devices, we will.
So I want to, when you say that there is no one person telling us like what to, you know, basically telling us to improve our surroundings, that it is a human condition, I completely agree. But I think the reason it isn't one person, it's because it's an entire it's a system of institutions that are telling us to improve our condition. And I think while humans have always improved their conditions, what we've done now is accelerated the rate of those improvements beyond, you know, like what the planet is capable of sustaining. And I think that's kind of what has led us to the problems that we have today, whether it is climate change or loneliness as an endemic. And right now we're in this rapid pace of growth. And I'm in startups, right? We're a venture capital backed startup, which means that the point of being venture capital backed is that you accelerate even faster than what would be a normal company. And I'm just quite interested around this idea of like sustainable and healthy growth. Yeah. And how can we do that for our team, our company, for our users, and for myself? So I wouldn't say that I'm completely dismissive of this age of the entrepreneur. I think that where I'm spending a lot of thinking time right now is how can we I guess I'm trying to have my cake and eat it. How can I be able to sustain? How can I be an entrepreneur? How can I satisfy my employees, my shareholders, my users, while also maintaining a sense of self-satisfaction, time for myself, to be able to build quality relationships with my friends and family? Yeah. These are the first thing that any founder or CEO will tell you goes.
Yeah.
Your health goes, your relationships go.
Yeah.
They're easier to cut off than it is to not answer that email or not take that meeting. So, yeah, I'm just trying to think, how can I do it all while also not, overworked?
I'm not an entrepreneur, so I can't speak from personal experience, but it strikes me that that tension, one of the reasons, one of the appeals to go, to me or to anybody, certainly to you, because you've done it, to go and create your own business is to free yourself from having to work for somebody else and somebody else's rules and somebody else's. And yet the trade-off, in a sense, is you become caged in by a whole different set of challenges, right?
That is exactly it. I tell people this all the time. You think you're starting a business to work for yourself. The minute you start a business, you're actually working for everybody else. Your time is not your own. But it does give you incredible freedom. And I would say that the thing that I love most about starting companies is, going back full circle to the beginning of this conversation, my fantasies are able to become realities through teamwork and through, ingenuity of all of the different skill sets that are around the table. I absolutely love working collaboratively and seeing things come to fruition. That was previously just sitting in my head.
Absolutely. I mean, you've sort of answered what I was about to ask you, which is, I'm sure, incredibly difficult, challenging, scary, lonely sometimes, all those things that you read about with successful entrepreneurs. But it also strikes me that it must be incredibly rewarding. You must get
a
sense of fulfillment when a plan comes together.
It's not just that. It's like when you hear from our users or from women, what they get back from our platform, it actually warms my soul and keeps me going. So the thing that makes me the happiest is helping our users really understand, critical thinking and also that the default that they've got right now is not necessarily how it has to be in any area of your life. We've refrained from being for a specific demographic, as in working women or moms or, just Gen Z women or students, because I think that it's not really the demographic of a type of woman that we're after, but it's more of the mindset. Yeah. It's a growth mindset. What is it that you want really in your life? And how can we help you get there? And that, when I hear back that we're helping people, that really warms my soul.
Yeah, that's a fantastic ambition. I mean, listening to you talk about the businesses that you've created and also this sort of internal dialogue external as well, dialogue around how the world is changing, how the world of work is changing, how your own personal ambitions to an extent are changing. Do you think that your leadership style has and is evolving?
I've really learned to separate leadership and management because it took me a long time to realize that there were two different things. I'm a much better leader, I think, than I am a manager, but I definitely had to learn how to be a manager and also how to motivate people when they weren't necessarily already partially motivated. Yeah. I would say that my leadership style, in fact, my 11-year-old son, who's taking the mick out of me the other day, because, cousin was in the house and I was saying, oh my goodness, I've got to go to these two meetings. I've been double booked. And she jokingly said, I'll go as you. And they won't be able to tell the difference because of the accent. And then my son, who's 11, chimed in, I'll go, Mum. This is what I have to say. Okay, so we're building an app and you can do it. It's really funny that he distilled my leadership in two sentences, which is, this is what we're going to do. And you can definitely do it, guys. And I would say that he's correct because he's very clever like that. It's My leadership style is laying out the work to be done, circling back on why we're doing it and providing the bigger mission, and then letting everybody know that they are important to this mission and that they all play a role. And then basically offline, breaking down everything that needs to be done to make sure it happens. And I think that that's where I thrive. So actually, you know, my leadership style is really suited to small teams.
Right.
Because that doesn't work beyond a certain size. And what I've realized, the biggest thing I've realized about myself is I excel in taking things from 0 to 10, and I need extra support in taking things from 10 to like 100 and then 100 to 1,000. Right. And I guess at that point, it's when people decide the role of founder CEOs, you start to transition and whether like you might be right for that. And at this point now, I'm sort of in the process of learning those skills. It's like, well, how do you lead a team of 500 if that's necessarily what you want to do? I think what is my leadership style really transparent? It's hard for me to say. I feel like you should ask my team.
Yeah,
really.
I'm just going to get your son on and ask him next time, because I think he's I think he's nailed it, hasn't he?
You've talked in the past, I think. Well, not just talked in the past, but you've written in the past. In fact, maybe I'm right in saying you do this every year. I'm not sure. But you sort of, at the end of the year, do a list of things that that went wrong or that, you know, that didn't work out how you wanted to. I'm not sure exactly the phraseology you use. Is that talk to me about that. That seems like quite a sort of soul-bearing exercise. Seems like possibly quite cathartic. What's the thinking behind it for you?
So I've got no qualms about saying when I've messed up. Even during this conversation, I don't pretend to have all the answers all the time, or, you know what I mean, just say like, this is exactly how it should be. And there's always a little bit, as a leader, of fake it till you make it, or as a founder, you know, I can put that confidence on when I need to. But I think that there is something very rewarding about saying where you might not have gotten things right, be it a type of information that you might need to make better decisions next time. At the end of the day, I think it's really unrealistic. It's a bit like what I said about raising a family, you know, having a child without your entire family around. It's completely unrealistic to give a 25, 32, 35-year-old first-time founder like millions of pounds and expect them to instantly know what to do. Like, that's ridiculous. There are startup founders every single day with more money than they've ever had in their bank account in their life, and suddenly 20 people to manage, and you expect them to instantly know what to do. That is ridiculous. Yeah. So I think that like, if I can do as much reflection as possible to see where there are gaps in my knowledge, the better that I can be for my business and for my, you know, as I said, my shareholders, my team and my users. Otherwise, you're just stumbling on and on blind. So the title of the article is Everything I Ever Got Wrong in 2019, or Everything I Got Wrong in 2020. Yeah, I think it is good to be reflective. I write a lot. I like sharing my thoughts. I've got a lot in my head, Chris. So I need to get it out in an organized fashion.
I think it's one of the things fascinating about it is your preparedness to share it, actually. I mean, I joke with people that I'm far more of an emotionally repressed northerner. So it's the sort of thing, you know, that I find quite hard to do. I admire the authenticity and the willingness to them and share them. Which I think is really unusual and interesting.
Do you know why I think it's important to share? Because otherwise we live off very surface level myths. So if we don't share the thinking, because these articles I would write would be a couple thousand words long, you would just, I feel like my audience or people who follow me on social media or see me out and about the town, they would be getting a snapshot, a blink in the eye of what my life might be like. And they're like, oh, you know, Sharma won the sword, or she's done this and she's done that. Everything must be incredible. And I actually think the medium of writing rather than social media Or even speaking, because while I'm speaking, I'm trying to process my thoughts as I'm talking. It's not the same as writing an article, going back, doing a draft, sharing it with your friends, getting their feedback on it. So I think it's really important for my audience to understand that what they see on social media is just one tiny, tiny element of what might be going on in my life or in my mind, and to not hold themselves up by what I'm doing, because I think I used to do that. I used to be like, oh my goodness, that person is, they've raised this amount of money, or they've done this thing, or they got this client, and you compare yourself to people, but you never know what sacrifices that person's made or what they've gone through. So I try and be as transparent as possible, because I'm very, very aware of my position as a unofficial big sister, which is what many of my members call me. I don't want to be a big sister that's got a face painted on, but you don't really what's underneath. I think that would be unfair to drive people in one direction.
So you've been, which we've talked about, you've been really, really effective at taking ideas and turning them into reality. Do you have any advice for anybody listening to this who has an idea, and where they would get started in terms of from the idea to reality?
Yeah, so as I've kind of flirted with on this conversation, is that I'm really, really interested in community and collectivism. And I think that when you have an idea, you sometimes might feel like I can be the only one to do it, or I have to work on this by myself, or I have to own the IP or the trademark. I hear this a lot. And what's going to happen if people steal my idea? And we've got this kind of very strong individualism in our culture today that makes people think they have to do everything by themselves. So my first piece of advice, if you have an idea, is try and build a team around your idea. And I don't just mean find a co-founder. I mean, essentially, kind of treat it like, as like I said earlier, a university project or a group task at school. You know, how many people can you get around the table to contribute to your idea in return for equity or payment or whatever it is, or just simply for the crack of it? You don't have to do it alone, which is definitely the mistake I made in like the first 10 years of my career as an entrepreneur. I thought I had to do everything myself, and that's just simply not true.
That's great advice. And that's takes me to my penultimate question, which is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
The best piece of advice I was given, to be honest, every time someone tells me something and it really irritates me and actually makes me a bit angry, that means it's usually correct.
Right,
yeah. And I remember one time somebody telling me, you're too in the weeds. Get out of the weeds. And it really irritated me. I was so angry. But actually, I think about it all the time, because it's very easy for me, as I said, to go into the detail and do things, like, because I can do them quicker, just get things done myself, instead of trying to stay at macro level where there are things that only I can have an impact on, as a CEO of the company.
Yeah.
I'm like trying to focus on those.
That's great advice. And so finally then, you've achieved so much. I mean, as you said earlier, you've achieved so much already. What's next?
So I don't think I've achieved that much, Chris, as I'm sure most founders or entrepreneurs will say to you. I think that I've scratched the surface of what we as a team are capable of. And what I'm really excited about next is the work that we're doing in around helping onboard our members into Web3. So we're launching a DAO as part of the Stack World. So a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization. Mm-hmm. So it means that a small group of our members will decide what happens within this DAO. We're giving them a whole bunch of education in Web3 so that they are aware of what is happening in this upside down world, as I like to call it. I think it's like a chance for me to experiment with collectivism at its extreme. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, how could I create like a mini co-op within the organization that I have and kind of fulfill those, you know, radicalist leanings that I was talking about earlier. Yeah. because I think it's important for the future of where technology is going, mm-hmm. Especially that women are not left behind, because otherwise I feel like we'll end up in a Web3 world that will just reflect, if not more reflect, the gross inequalities that we see right now. But I also think for my own satisfaction, I love a DAO. When I first read about a DAO, I was like, wow, this is the vehicle I've been waiting yeah. for all my life. Like, this is truly exciting.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. And we look forward to seeing the outcome of that, the business of the future. So we'll have you back on to get us to get you to tell us how it all goes. So, Sharmadeen, it's been absolutely fascinating and inspiring talking to you. I really, really appreciate your time. Of all the people we've had on, there hasn't been anybody who I've asked so few of the actual pre-prepared questions and just let the conversation...
I apologize for taking you off topic.
No, it's been your answers have been far more interesting than my questions. So I really appreciate it. And thanks so much for your time. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to rate and review No Bullshit Leadership on Apple Podcasts. It lets us know what you think and helps others to find the show. Thank you.